dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week in our reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, she discussed the limitations of what can be achieved by labor unions as long as they accept the logic of capitalism, working as employees for owners who control production and seize the surplus. Last week's news provided us with an example in the widely covered sit-in by workers at the Republic Window and Door Factory in Chicago. It ended last week with a settlement that was hailed as a victory. Let's look at that. The company decided to close its unionized plant and shut its doors abruptly without providing the 60-day notice required by law for plant closures. Wages and vacation pay already earned by workers was not paid. The company said it could not pay because Bank of America had refused it a line of credit. Because Bank of America had been one of the recipients of taxpayer bailout funds, politicians got involved, pressure was applied, and B of A and J.P. Morgan Bank coughed up a loan, and the workers were paid. That's the good news. The bad news is that the workers are all now unemployed, and their next job is likely to be non-union and pay even less. The Republic workers are members of UE, an independent member-run union with a long history of militant organizing. As a result of their action, donations of solidarity poured in from around the world. The union is now discussing finding a way to reopen the plant under new ownership, using the donation money to start a fund for that purpose. Contrast this with what has been occurring in Argentina in response to the current as well as previous economic crisis there. Workers are seizing the facilities abandoned by the capitalists and running them as worker-owned cooperatives, quite successfully demonstrating that the least necessary part of an enterprise, from the standpoint of producing useful goods and services, is the capitalist, whose focus is on making money, not on meeting needs. These takeovers, however, from the standpoint of capitalist law, are stealing. Capitalist law does not recognize as stealing the involuntary removal of livelihood from entire communities. The Republic action illustrates just how bad the situation is for working people in this country when just getting paid what you are owed translates to a victory. Capitalism, aka the free market, is treated in the United States somewhat as if it were a religion, some divine set of rules and laws that may not be questioned, especially since the so-called Reagan Revolution. This obscures the fact that it is a system of human creation, which in the four centuries or so that it has been in existence has had continual cycles of boom and bust, and always leads to concentrations of wealth and larger concentrations of poverty. Representative David Obie, a Wisconsin Democrat who chairs the House Appropriations Committee, candidly admitted as much in his opening statement at a hearing on the economic conditions of the states last week.
This country is in what appears to be the most dangerous recession since 1932. And I think both parties are pushing different explanations for what happened. The Democratic Party seems to generally claim that this recession started because of nefarious activities on Wall Street. And the Republican Party seems to suggest that it started in the housing areas. And I think, frankly, that that narrative is wrong on both sides. To me, what has happened is that if you go back to 1980, from 1980 through today, virtually 80% of all of the income growth that occurred in this country went to the wealthiest 10% of American families. And in fact, in this decade, starting in the year 2000, about 95% of all of the income growth in the country has gone to the top 10%. And so I think average families have tried to respond to what was essentially a freeze in their real income over time by trying to borrow. And so they borrowed more for student aid, to send their kids to college, they borrowed more for housing, they borrowed more for health care, borrowed more for a lot of things they needed and probably some things they didn't need. And at the same time that that happened, you had all of these new instruments that were being developed on Wall Street, accompanied by a substantial reduction in regulation of those activities. And so I will readily grant that housing and Wall Street finance were the triggering events. But I think the basic problem is, as I just described, the long-term erosion of the ability of average working people to raise their income over time. And so now we are faced with the consequences of that problem. We were told by an economist from Moody's, for instance, in the Democratic caucus just 2 days ago, that even if we pass a $700 billion so-called stimulus package, that we can still expect unemployment, which right now is hovering close to 7%, we can still expect unemployment in a year and a half to be hovering around 9%. I think that's totally unacceptable, and I think that indicates just how serious this recession could be. We've lost 2 million jobs in the last year. The growth in population and labor force means unemployment has expanded by even more, by 3.1 million. One in eight persons in the labor force is either unemployed or underemployed. And we're getting very sad-looking predictions and projections and forecasts from economists throughout the country. Even many conservative economists who normally advise the Congress to leave it to the Federal Reserve to respond to the recession are now advising Congress to shore up the economy with more temporary, and I emphasize temporary, spending. The federal government, it seems, is about the only game in town to provide a lift to the economy. As the economy shrinks, we can anticipate more large reductions in real revenues coming into the states and coming into the federal government. And falling revenues are going to force those states to either cut important services or to raise taxes. And that will create a major fiscal drag on the economy. And we also will be experiencing a human dimension. Losing a job and not being able to find a new one undermines the dignity of unemployed workers and puts a financial strain on the whole family and the whole community. And so I think there's generalized agreement we have to make every reasonable effort to prevent things from getting much worse. The downward momentum appears to be very strong, but it is to be hoped that a well-designed economic recovery program could help slow it.
Anyone who imagines that the Democrats are planning to end capitalism should be disabused by this clip from a presentation made by Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank. chair of the House Financial Services Committee. He was speaking on December 4th at a conference held by the Consumer Federation of America.
We have been governed philosophically by the view that the way to improve the quality of life, to the extent that government is involved, is simply by taking all the strength off capital. That really was ushered in by Ronald Reagan in 1980. I remember his first inaugural. It was my first year as a member of Congress, in which he said, government is not the answer to our problem. Government is the problem. That was the conservative philosophy that was really quite dominant, intellectually and to some extent politically, until fairly recently. Even during the Clinton administration, where there was some break with that, President Clinton felt compelled to kind of at least pay lip service to that. Of all the things that he had said or done with which I had the most trouble, and I was generally very supportive of him and admiring of his record, is when he said in the State of the Union speech, the era of big government is over. And my problem was that I was concerned because there had apparently been this era of big government and I was absent that day. I wanted to know when that era of big government had been, in which the government had overreached and done too much. It had almost always seemed to me to be doing too little in terms of promoting the quality of life. Well, that philosophy, however, was dominant. It was leave capital alone. Don't tax it. Don't regulate it. Don't interfere with its free, unrestricted movement internationally, and it will reward you all. Everybody will be wealthier and be better off. And that philosophy was fairly strong as recently as 2006 in November, a little over 2 years ago, when the Democrats won the congressional elections. And I was the chairman in waiting of the Financial Services Committee. What I mostly heard was, your task is to deregulate further. People forget. I advise people, go back and as Casey Stenger would say, you could look it up. You will see people telling us that we had driven American financial activity offshore. And the general thrust was, we are in danger of diminishing America's financial activity by overregulating. Fast forward to today. 1981, Ronald Reagan's announcement is that the government is not the answer to our problem, government is the problem. For the past year, the Secretary of the Treasury, in a very conservative administration, this administration is far more conservative than the first Bush administration, it's more conservative than the Nixon administration, it's second only to the Reagan administration in the degree of its conservatism recently, and what is the motto of the Secretary of the Treasury? It is this, what used to be a bad joke that conservatives told about liberals, because we have gone from government is not the answer to our problem, government is the problem, to a Secretary of the Treasury who is going up and down the financial community of America and telling them, I am from the government and I am here to help you. That is exactly the role that Mr. Paulson has played, on the whole, well, I think, although I have some differences with him lately, but that's the change. From deregulate to the Secretary of the Treasury and the head of the Federal Reserve now acknowledging that we've got to regulate. And I think it's very clear. We're in the third era, or the third example of a very understandable pattern in economic history. The private sector innovates. They come up with a new form of economic activity that has a great deal of benefit, because if it doesn't have any benefit, it dies of its own weight. If there's no value added, it doesn't attract anything. But while it produces benefits, by definition, because it's innovative, there are no rules to contain it. So it does some good and some harm. And the role of the public sector then is to come into the situation with rules that confine the activity without stifling it. That's why I think our problem recently, technically, has not been deregulation. It has been non-regulation. It is not that regulations were taken off activities, but that as a new set of activities came up, they were not regulated. There was not previously a rule for regulating credit default swaps because there was no such thing. It was a failure to put the rules in. Now, I said there's a pattern here. The first one I think of is the late 19th century when industrialists began to create large industrial enterprises, oil and steel and coal and railroads. And without them, we would not have had the wealth we had in society. those large enterprises, I believe, were necessary for creating broad-scale industrialization and its benefits. But there weren't any rules. So after they get created in the late 19th century, in the early 20th century, Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson spend a lot of that time coming up with rules to contain them, not to wipe them out, but to have the benefit of their activity without the harm, the antitrust acts, the Federal Trade Commission, aspects of the Federal Reserve. Then one thing leads to another. Because you now have this set of large enterprises, you need the stock market much more because no individual can finance this, or a small group of individuals. So you get the finance capitalism of the stock market, very beneficial in a lot of ways, but again, without adequate rules. So Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal spend much of their energy putting rules around the stock market, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Investment Company Act, et cetera. Now, in both cases, you got regulation that was very pro-market and pro-capitalist. The antitrust acts were to keep competition alive, the very justification for capitalism. If it hadn't been for an SEC, you would not have had a functioning stock market, because when people get screwed enough, they say, the hell with this, and they don't invest anymore.
The debate within government is about how to make capitalism survive, not whether it should survive, which is the debate we need. Capitalism is based on a 17th century assumption that there exists an endless supply of materials, commodities, and labor that can and should be marshaled to create continual economic growth through buying and selling. It's led to the dangerous destruction of our ecosystem and is on a collision course with climate change because the remedies required to preserve the ecosystem necessitate decreasing as well as different practices of consumption and production. From the ecological perspective, less is more. It is prudent and responsible, in fact, urgently necessary. From the capitalist point of view, it's a disaster, a severe decrease in economic activity, a reversal of economic growth, a depression. As long as we remain within the system and premises of capitalism, we can neither make human needs a priority nor take the necessary steps to avert a crisis of mass extinction of our species and most others caused by the pollution from our wasteful industrial societies. Societies that are increasing in size each year, driven by the imperatives of growth. Every proposal for dealing with our ecological situation seems to be accepted or rejected based on its ability to generate profit rather than results. Bottom line, the right-wingers are correct. What's good for the environment is bad for profits. And when we stop pretending otherwise, we're going to be able to have a meaningful discussion. Because the health of our ecosphere is not negotiable. It's a prerequisite for life itself. To choose capitalism over the ecosphere is to choose death, which is why I believe either capitalism goes or we go. What's so on the ecosystem level is also true on the personal level. Healthy people are bad for the economy. As my friend Jill often says, cancer and pollution are good for the GDP. That sounds crazy until one understands how the GDP is calculated. The very first episode of this show that aired in March 2000 featured a talk by Marilyn Waring, the author of If Women Counted. In it, she explained how the GDP is calculated. The GDP, the gross domestic product, is used as the measure of economic growth. You may be as surprised to learn as I was that there is no debit side of the ledger in this GDP calculation. Any activity that involves the exchange of money is added as a positive to the GDP number, even if it is the cleanup of a catastrophic oil tanker accident or reconstruction of a city leveled by a hurricane, or hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on medical treatment by a person suffering from a life-threatening disease. Useful work, which is not waged, much of it traditionally performed by women, is not counted in the GDP. I assume it's not controversial to assert that eating organically grown fresh fruits and vegetables and getting exercise is good for one's health. So if you decide in the new year to plant a garden and get some exercise working in it, to give up the fast food meals and snack foods, drive less and walk more, and go to the park to play basketball instead of watching it on cable TV while consuming chips and beer, you'll be having a positive effect on your health and a negative effect on the economy. If masses of people embarked on this health program, fast food restaurants would close, leaving those workers unemployed. There would be job cuts at the conglomerates that make processed foods, and the waste disposal companies would cut back on their workforce and buy fewer garbage trucks. The waste from the produce you grow would be composted and used to fertilize next year's garden, as opposed to those plastic potato chip bags that had to be hauled away by the trash company. The people that make a living selling drugs and treatments for obesity, heart disease, and diabetes would have a reduction in staffing, landing even more people on the unemployment line, etc. Obviously, there's something completely insane about an economy that profits from disaster. On the program this week and continuing into the new year, I'm going to bring you presentations from a conference confronting the global triple crisis that examines the way these various problems we face are related, that analyzes the false solutions that are being proposed and proposes actual solutions. In Power and Powerlessness, Susan Rosenthal termed one of the premises of capitalism as compete or die. Capitalism is an evolutionary dead end. Whatever benefits it may have brought are now outweighed by its harms. We must now cooperate or die. The call for this revolution in human affairs will not come from presidents and legislators. It is up to us. Change or die. Evolve or die. The International Forum on Globalization is an organization that has brought together some of the top thinkers and activists addressing these questions. They're people who've understood the issues for a long time. In mid-September, they held a conference with a diverse range of speakers in an attempt to synthesize knowledge towards solutions. The conference was opened by Jerry Mander, director and founder of the IFG. Mander is also the program director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Back in the 1960s, he was president of a major San Francisco advertising company before he turned his talents to environmental campaigns that kept dams out of the Grand Canyon, established Redwood National Park, and stopped the production of the supersonic transport. His books include Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, 1977, In the Absence of the Sacred, 1991, The Case Against the Global Economy and for a Turn Toward the Local, co-edited with Edward Goldsmith in 1996, and his most recent, Alternatives to Economic Globalization, A Better World is Possible.
What a thrill to see you all here. My name is Jerry Mander. I'm from the International Forum on Globalization. And on behalf of the IFG and our great partner in this event, the Institute for Policy Studies, I want to thank you all for coming to what we think will be an historic event, certainly the first of its kind in the U.S. You will hear from an extremely diverse group, including mainstream environmental activists and more radical deep ecology activists, from human rights, indigenous rights, social justice groups, anti-militarism, anti-war campaigners, economists working toward new ecological economic systems that will keep us within the boundaries of nature, scientists who are trying to cut through the blizzard of false solutions now being proposed to, in order to really understand, for example, which renewable systems make sense in a post-carbon world and which may not. Other scientists, such as conservation biologists speaking for the natural world. We'll have agricultural activists seeking to sustain local farming for local communities as key to any future transition. We'll also have people deeply involved in the hands-on negotiations in Geneva, from both European and third world perspectives, seeking post-Kyoto formulas and models that can actually work. We also have activists whose work is demanding that U.S. policy change and that there be major political change. And we'll have people who are not waiting for any change at all or for any formulas, and they're just going out and doing taking the situation in hand themselves, but are already building new local systems, new communities, transition towns, ecological, local farming, and others focused more on issues of overconsumption, lifestyle change, and the like. It's a very highly eclectic group. Many of these people have never met each other before, but we believe this diversity and cross-fertilization will help build a really strong movement, because all of us are needed if we're really to succeed. So my job is to be the first speaker and to put on the table the basic set of circumstances that bring us together for this weekend. The planet's ecological, social, and economic systems are now on the verge of catastrophic change, and very few societies are prepared for it. Efforts by governments to respond to the emergency are inadequate. Efforts by corporations and industry to reform themselves remain largely contained by systemic limits that place economic growth and profit above all other standards of performance, including the social good. Efforts by politicians so far are self-serving and empty. With each passing month, the probability of cataclysm increases and will continue to do so if we don't immediately alter course. Some say global ecological and social breakdowns are already inevitable, as I think we'll hear from Simon Retallick and Dave Corton in a minute or two. With great crises also comes great opportunity. The very urgency of the situation brings new incentives for more viable economic and social choices that operate within the carrying capacity of the planet. So we should not view this crisis as entirely negative. It has the potential to accelerate transitions to far more successful economic and political forms. And as the new DiCaprio movie says, we are nearing the 11th hour. The emergency evolves from the convergence of three advancing conditions: the increase of climate change affecting all regions of the Earth, the imminent end of the era of cheap energy, which is called peak oil, which will bring dramatic shifts in all operating assumptions of society, and the extensive depletion of other key resources basic to the industrial system, as well as to human welfare: fresh water, genetic resources, forests, fish and wildlife, fertile soils, coral reefs, and most elements of the local, regional, and global commons. The expected extinction of up to 50% of all species in the next half century. We'll hear more about that from Stuart Pym and about the water crisis from Maud Barlow. We are calling the deadly convergence the triple crisis. All three problems are rooted in the same systemic circumstances and can be slowed by the same systemic changes. The solutions to each are the solutions to all. As our colleague and great friend Teddy Goldsmith has been saying for three decades, from this moment forward, we have to do exactly the opposite of what we have been doing in every possible way. We wish he was well enough to be with us here tonight. The causes of this situation are not mysterious. They're obvious, actually, rooted in the following: an economic system utterly dependent upon exponential economic growth and the race to dig up the earth for ever more natural resources to feed that growth. This despite the fact that on a finite planet, the very concept of never-ending growth is preposterous and a little bit mad. The corresponding global spread of commodity-oriented economic systems that promote consumerism as the primary and maybe only means to individual happiness and fulfillment. A half century of reckless use of fossil fuels to fuel the above fantasies. The destruction of cultures that have traditionally offered sustainable alternative economic models and practices. Indigenous and agricultural societies that have seen their lands and livelihoods destroyed for industrial purposes. The profound systemic disrespect and disregard of planetary limits in terms of resource availabilities, consumption, and waste generation. Finally, overpopulation, which exacerbates all the other conditions and has grown far beyond the capacity of the Earth to sustain. This combination of conditions is likely to soon bring global environmental and social crises on an heretofore unprecedented scale. Global warming threatens the loss of much of the world's most productive lands, physical upheavals in many places from storms and rising waters, massive dislocations, desertification of agricultural lands, ice caps melting, islands disappearing, great species gone, and economic and social tragedy for well into the future, with problems particularly severe for the poorest nations and peoples. Peak oil, which is the term that describes the global decline of inexpensive oil and gas supplies, deeply threatens the long-term survival of industrial nations and industrialism itself at its present scale. Inexpensive energy has been the key underpinning of our economic system for the last century. Long-distance transport, industrial food systems, complex urban and suburban systems, and many commodities basic to our present way of life, autos, plastics, chemicals, pesticides, refrigeration, are all rooted in the basic assumption of ever-increasing inexpensive energy supply. Without cheap energy, all are threatened. And the other resource shortages that I've mentioned, fresh water, forests, agricultural lands, biodiversity, make the survival of humans and other species far more tenuous than at any time in human history. As all these crises advance, so do major geopolitical problems, as nation-states fall into bloody competition for survival. We already see advanced resource wars over oil, and as in Iraq and Sudan, the coming wars over water, and the many struggles for control of diminishing natural gas supplies, freshwater, key minerals, and so on. We'll hear more about those matters from Michael Clare and, I think, Vandana Shiva in the context of viable agriculture. As grim as these scenarios are, they become inevitable only if individuals and nations do not seize this moment for systemic transformation, to reset societies within value systems and pathways that accept the limits of the Earth. And that's what we're here to talk about. Well, we're surely not hearing anything like that from the United States government, of course. My old friend, the radio journalist and humorist Scoop Nisker, I know many of you here know him, Wes Nisker, likens the global catastrophe before us as sort of like the dark scenarios from apocalyptic meteor movies of the 1950s. You know, a meteor is about to hit the Earth, and it will destroy all life as we know it. The President of the United States, usually played by someone like Henry Fonda, or more recently Morgan Freeman, and Fred Thompson lately, the President goes on global television to grimly announce the realities facing the world. "We are doing everything scientifically possible to avert the catastrophe," he says. "We've launched a nuclear spaceship that we hope will collide with the comet and divert or explode it. Technology will save us." Nuclear technology, actually. Well, people, a meteor-type thing is about to hit the Earth with similar outcomes. But our president is not Morgan Freeman or Henry Fonda. It's George Bush. And he's not worried. He sees it as a business opportunity. Bush, as far as I can see, has a four-point plan. One, keep the Iraq war going till that damn oil deal with U.S. companies is signed. Two, maybe invade Iran a little bit if he can get away with it. There's lots of oil there, and Dick Cheney certainly has evidence that Osama bin Laden lives there now. Three, grow the carbon economy as fast as possible to the very last drop. And four, continue to stall all attempts to advance meaningful international agreements. The Bush strategy is really less the stuff of meteor movies than road warrior movies. The last man standing wins. What a plan. The government is working on other solutions, too. Our military community is trying to lock up the last resources on Earth, wherever on the planet they are. These include water, probably Canada's, forests, probably Canada's, genetic diversity as well as oil, also Canada's, but that's only part one. Other proposed solutions include these: high-speed global transition to biofuels as some kind of panacea, new technologies of carbon sequestration to achieve so-called clean coal, the annual revival of nuclear energy. And let's not forget another important part of the American response to the crisis, shopping green, joining the green consumption bandwagon. Shop to save the planet seems like the mantra right now. You can scarcely turn on TV without seeing all the latest innovations from power companies, car companies, chemical companies, all promoting terrific green products. Check out a website called Climate Cooler, which has slogans like, "The more you shop, the greener it gets." Here's the idea. You buy your new jeans or computer from the website, and part of the proceeds goes to some big environmental groups, none of them in this crowd, to offset the greenhouse gases caused by producing those products. It's carbon trading through shopping. Is that American or what? With good ideas like that, maybe everything is okay for the polar bears after all. But in all the hoopla, does anyone ever mention conservation? Using less stuff, not consuming the planet's last resources. That wouldn't be helpful to corporate investors. Let's get back to the fuel ideas. The idea of clean coal depends on the successful invention of new technologies to achieve carbon sequestration. Optimistic projections say that it will last another decade or two before we begin to achieve that. However, it's not just the emissions from coal that are the problem. There's also the mining. As Marianne Hitt of Appalachian Voices reports, more than 500 mountaintops have been literally blown off to uncover the coal inside. In the middle of what used to be glorious forest-covered West Virginia, once you get off the scenic highway for a minute, you might as well be in Sahara or Armageddon, except here you have poisoned soil and rivers and a local population desperately fleeing the scene. We'll have a great workshop on that with Marianne and Jeff Goodell tomorrow morning. Clean nuclear power. Probably they have a plan for mixing together the radioactive waste together with the sequestered carbon, someplace where very poor people live and might accept it. American Indian communities have experienced the first rounds of that, and they're not eager for another. But the big-time panacea is biofuels. George Bush says they'll free us from oil dependency. He wants to see 35 billion gallons of auto fuel from bioagriculture in the next 10 years. He's pushing subsidies nearly equal to the Iraq war costs, going to giant ag corporations to help make this happen. The loyal opposition, Barack and Hillary, and most other presidential candidates, as well as Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, are falling right in line. Pelosi, who's from my district, is joining Bush's fight to give the hugest subsidies in history to the biggest agricultural corporations in the world. These companies used to run ads about how they are feeding a hungry world. Now they're abandoning the hunger slogan for the climate slogan, converting farmlands in the U.S. to corn for ethanol, not food. They're also building agri-fuel plantations in other parts of the world, especially in poor and indigenous areas of South America, India, Asia, and Africa, driving tens of thousands of people from land where they once grew food so corporations can now grow fuel. We'll hear about that tomorrow, too. But that's your 21st century ad slogan, feed cars, not people. According to Jack Santa Barbara's report that you should all have in your packets, it takes 450 pounds of corn to make enough ethanol to fill one tank of gas in an SUV. That's enough calories for an average person to live for a full year. But don't despair. You can still always buy a Prius. Listen, I live in Marin County, California. I don't want to make my friends and neighbors mad, but that's the Prius capital of the world. Families are turning up with 2, 3, and 4 Priuses in front of their houses so that every member of the family can help save the planet. I'm making fun of this, but I know they're earnestly trying to do the right thing, as we all are trying to do. And hybrids use less fuel. That's the good news. But there's so much more to the story. What is that car made of? Where did all the materials come from? What are the social and environmental consequences of those mines? Nickel mines, for example, for building Prius batteries, have devastated a huge swath of Ontario, Canada again. How much energy was used to mine, process, ship across oceans, and build all the parts to assemble that thing? Is the energy saved by higher fuel mileage equal to the energy used to ship all the component parts from the mines in Africa or South America to processing in Japan or Korea to assembly in Thailand to additional processes in Eastern Europe and Wales to markets in the U.S., Japan, and Europe? How do we calculate that? In a couple of minutes, Annie Leonard will take us through a great exercise about global materials flow from mine to store to junk heap. There's a new scientific discipline now called life cycle assessment, including all the processes and materials in all aspects of mining and production from dust to dust. By all reports, hybrids may turn out to be more of a marketing success than a sustainability success. They may be the best among new cars, but from a save the planet point of view, the best choice is probably a good used car. Tomorrow night, we'll have a panel circling around all that. Shopping, consumerism, corporatism, global corporate capitalism, growth as a god, using up the materials of the earth to feed the industrial juggernaut, that is the modern world. That's what got us into this place. I don't think the idea is to use better, new, greener products. It's to use less. Here are the slogans I think we need for the future. Power down. That's one. Less energy and less materials. Less and local. That's another, to save the planet. So, that's more or less what we're going to talk about this weekend. And to address some fundamental questions. How do we separate real solutions from false solutions? Can we assume a future that is anything like the present? Are export-oriented economies, the heart of the globalization model, survivable given their dependence on energy-intensive transportation? Let me break the tension on that one. They're not survivable. Can corporations locked into a system that requires economic growth and never-ending resource use and profit in order to survive, can they ever play a useful role, or are they kaput? Does green business change any of that? Can renewable technologies keep our industrial system functioning at its present bloated level? Should we even try to do that? Can technology save us? Is equity achievable on a planet of diminishing resources? If so, how? Does the present industrial system have a chance to survive in a resource-depleted world? If not, is that bad? How will we live in a world that actually takes seriously a sustainable future for all people? If the current system is non-viable, then what's Plan B? That's what we're going to talk about. Thank you so much for being with us. So now I get to introduce other people. And now we're going to turn the focus sharply onto climate change. And I'm going to introduce Simon Retallack. Climate change, of course, is the first leg of the three-legged stool that we're dealing with here. Simon is the head of the climate change team at the Institute for Public Policy Research in the United Kingdom. It's the UK's leading independent progressive think tank. He specializes in climate change policy and has written about most of the world's other major environmental problems. He's the co-author of IPPR's 2007 report, Positive Energy, Harnessing People Power to Prevent Climate Change. He's the co-author of IPPR's report, Trading Up, Reforming the EU Emissions Trading Scheme. And he's the author of their report, Setting a Long-Term Climate Objective. Simon has been a longtime associate member of the International Forum on Globalization, has participated in all of our teach-ins, including ones going as far back as Riverside Church in New York and Seattle. He was also the editor of The Ecologist magazine for quite a while and on the board of directors of Redefining Progress and contributed to the book Alternatives to Economic Globalization. So, it's my pleasure to introduce our friend Simon Retallack.
Thank you very much, Jerry. I'm delighted to be here to talk about the first of the triple crises, climate change or global warming. All of us in this room will have our own stories to tell about how the climate is changing where we live. I'm sure you all we'll have such a story. If we look at the last 2 months alone, we can see how the problem of climate change is very real. In the UK, where I live, torrential rain this summer caused the worst floods in living memory, leaving 50,000 homes without power, 350,000 people without drinking water. In China, it was much worse this summer. They had once-in-a-century rains and floods in July that forced 3.6 million people from their homes. Bangladesh, too, saw a third of its landmass underwater, 30 million people displaced. An important article in the scientific journal Nature in July confirmed scientists' view that climate change has significantly changed global rainfall patterns over the last century. That hasn't just brought more rainfall. In some parts of the world, it's produced drier conditions in others. And so also, over the last 12 months, we've seen widespread drought across the wheat-producing belt that's helped push the price of wheat up. In Australia, they've had the worst drought for 1,000 years. In Greece this summer, they've had the worst forest fires in over a century. It's destroyed more than 100 villages, killed dozens of people and cost billions of dollars, following record summer temperatures and hot, dry winds, which made Greece a tinderbox. All of these examples show that climate change is not an abstract, distant problem. It's affecting real people, real livelihoods, real homes right now. And this is just a taste of what will happen unless the appropriate action is taken. This year's landmark scientific report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change confirmed that warming by the end of this century will be worse than expected unless sufficient action is taken, with probable temperature rises, they said, of between 1.8 to 4 degrees centigrade, and possibly much higher, up to 6.4 degrees. Their conclusions are conservative because they're a consensus-driven, government-approved organization in which the Bush administration and its officials also contribute. What it doesn't include is uncertainties in how the carbon cycle feedback system can kick in or the full effects of changes, for example, in the ice sheet flow. This is a particularly worrying area in the science of climate change. News was published just last week that the Greenland ice cap is melting so quickly that it's causing earthquakes as pieces of ice several cubic miles in size break off. Events there are happening far faster than scientists anticipated. Instead of the 60 centimeter rise in sea levels that the IPCC predict from the melting of the ice caps by the end of this century, it's possible scientists working in Greenland itself that we may see 2 meters worth of sea level rise. If the whole of the ice sheet goes, it's a total of 7 meters that you'll see sea levels rising by. Imagine what that will do to downtown Manhattan or Miami or New Orleans. There's a growing consensus around the world that we should agree that temperatures globally should not rise by more than 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels if we're to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. The other most important report on climate change in the last 12 months was the Stern Review on the economics of climate change commissioned by the UK government. The Stern Review set out the implications of exceeding a rise of 2 degrees centigrade, which is about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. They said, we will see falling crop yields in many developing regions, up to 60% increase in people at risk of hunger, over 1 billion people at risk of suffering water shortages, the possible onset of the collapse of the Amazon rainforest, up to 50% of species facing extinction, an increase in hurricane frequency leading to a doubling of damage costs in the US alone, and critically, the risk of weakening the natural system of carbon absorption and an increase in natural methane releases, as well as the weakening of the Atlantic Gulf Stream, which brings temperate climate to northern Europe. and the onset of the irreversible melting of the Greenland ice sheet. Stern also concluded the costs of ignoring climate change far outweighed the costs of action itself. Whilst the costs of ignoring climate change, he estimated, were up to 20% of global GDP, the costs of acting were as little as 1%. We've done analysis in our institute of what it would take to avoid that rise of 2 degrees C. To have a high chance of avoiding it, global emissions of CO2 would need to peak in less than 10 years, achieve a maximum rate of decline of 4 to 5% every year by 2015 or to 2020, and to fall to about 70 to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. Now, for developed countries, those cuts will need to be even larger. Those figures are important. Remember them. To have a high chance of avoiding the worst impacts of dangerous climate change, we need to curb the growth of global CO2 emissions within the next 10 years and see cuts of at least 80% within just 45 years. Of course, what's happening on the ground is the opposite of what we need. The growth in global CO2 emissions from fossil fuels over the last 5 years was 4 times greater than for the preceding 10 years. Instead of falling by 4 to 5%, which is what we need, CO2 emissions are rising by 3% every year. Of course, the biggest obstacle to a global solution on climate change has been the Bush administration. The tragedy of the last 8 years is that it was our global misfortune to have in charge of the most important country, the most powerful country, the biggest polluter in the world, the Bush administration, which, let's face it, is nothing more than a wholly owned subsidiary of the oil industry. But the basic fact is this. At the US federal level, there is still no mandatory cap on US emissions. Now, all of that was pretty depressing, and I apologize. It's true that things are changing on climate change. There is a significant political, even corporate media, judicial and public momentum in favor of taking action worldwide that didn't exist even 2 years ago. Partly it's been the result of efforts such as those of Al Gore's and his movie An Inconvenient Truth, but equally there's been a sea change in attitudes amongst some companies. What we do desperately need to do now is translate that increase in awareness into action. We urgently need a new global deal for post-2012 when the Kyoto Protocol's first commitment period comes to an end. Beyond that, there is no plan at the global level right now to ensure that emissions are reduced in an adequate way. We have a critical meeting coming up in Indonesia this December that needs to begin the process of building that successor to the Kyoto Protocol. But for that to happen, the US must move. If the US does not move at the national level on this issue and agree a binding cap, I think we'll have major problems convincing other developed and developing countries to follow suit. There has been movement in the US that's definitely a sign of significant hope. At the state level in particular, we've seen a number of leading states taking new action, notably California with its pledge to cut its emissions to 2000 levels by 2010, 1990 levels by 2020, and an 80% cut by 2050. And Florida, only this July, has followed suit with a pledge to cut its emissions by 40% by 2025, which is very significant. But even these efforts and others like it at the sub-federal level are not enough. We need a national cap on greenhouse gases in the US. There are several bills before Congress that would seek to cap US emissions. And this fall could see a bill being reported to the full Senate for the first time that would try to do that. However, of the 9 bills being considered, most just won't do the job. Only 1 in the Senate and 1 before the House proposed to cut US emissions by 80%, which is the least that's needed for the US to do its fair share. And most postpone action whereas what we need is reductions now. Let's be clear about this. There's no point in making half-hearted efforts. In the end, we either reduce emissions enough to avoid dangerous climate change, or we don't. And if we don't, there'll be little left to do about it, but simply try to adapt. We also need to ensure that the right technological solutions are in place. We need to treat proposals on biofuels, coal, nuclear, with extreme care and caution. We need solutions on to climate change that are socially and environmentally responsible, that help us build a healthier as well as a fairer world. And I think most renewable technologies, allied to massive improvements in energy efficiency, can do just that. But we are at a critical point on this issue, where public pressure could make all the difference, particularly in the US. The battle is on to shape a new future. If we fail to take part in that battle, we will cede our place to the vested interests who want to slow everything up to carry on with business as usual for as long as they can. We must all engage. All of you here have an important role to play, not least in the upcoming elections for the White House, but equally, day to day, right now, in movements that are working to ensure that the right action is taken at the national level, with groups such as Greenpeace and Al Gore's Alliance for Climate Protection and new coalitions that are being proposed. So sign up. Do your part. It's true that there's still a huge gulf to bridge between what's necessary, which for me is nothing less than a crash program, and what seems possible. We do only have 10 years to act, but I think we can do it. Thanks.
That was Confronting the Global Triple Crisis, an interdisciplinary conference organized by the International Forum on Globalization, held in Washington, D.C. in mid-September. We'll continue with another presentation from the conference, then conclude the show with the next installment of the serial reading from Power and Powerlessness, a 2006 book by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
Now it's my great pleasure to introduce one of my most people who's inspired me most in my life, and that is Vandana Shiva. Of course, you all know her, I guess. She's a physicist, a tremendous activist. She's the founder of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy in New Delhi. She's a founding board member of the IFG. She's received the Right Livelihood Award in 1993, and 2001 was named among the top five most important people in Asia by Asia Week magazine. She's the author of more than 100 papers in leading journals and numerous books, including Monocultures of the Mind, Biodiversity, Biotechnology, and the Third World, and Earth Democracy, but none of that says who she is. She's really a fantastic leader, a powerful thinker, and an inspiration to tens of thousands of people in India and everywhere else. She's managed to cross over in so many ways and with such brilliance, and I'm happy to introduce Vandana.